about the imaginary part of the action and the large spin for simplex amplitude. Yasha?
Hello. Can you hear me, good people?
Yes, go ahead.
Yes, we do. Okay. So today I'd like to report on what happens when you are stuck in a faraway country in a room with Norbert Bodendorfer. The roots of today's project are in an observation made half a year ago that the action of Lorentzian gravity has an imaginary part. Okay. That subject itself is broader than what I'll be presenting today, and if you're interested in more, I refer to the recorded seminar I recently gave in Perimeter. So when I presented this complex action business at Penn State, the first response from Abai was, but what about first-order actions, because originally it was about the second-order action. And the response from Norbert was, well, let's look for it in spin phones. So the present project is the result of doing those things. So slide number two has an outline and summary of the results. So we start by doing some spring cleaning of the Palatini and Holst first order actions, which ends up showing that they are equivalent to each other and to the second order action, not only in that they give the same field equations, but also that the on-shell actions are equal. So it is sensible to talk about the action of GR. Then I'll go through the fact that this action has an imaginary part, which in GR is given through the areas of certain surfaces, and in more general theories of gravity is related to the world entropy formula. And then we go over to look at the spin foam amplitudes in LQG and show that once we understand that the correct classical action of GR has an imaginary part, then the large spin for simplex amplitude only reproduces it if we analytically continue gamma to plus minus I in the end. Then this combines with some other recent work. Jorge, there's some noise that we're hearing tapping. Do you know what that is?
No, that sounds like someone's cell phone interfering with a speakerphone, but let's go ahead.
Okay. So that then leads to first ever agreement in LQG between the black hole entropy as derived semi-classically from an effective action and the statistical entropy derived from a microscopic state counting, that is, for the first time, including the correct numerical prefactor. Okay? And finally, there's an interpretational, more speculative point that we should be thinking really about the large spin limit of LQG and spin phones as a limit of quanta with very high transplanckian energy. Right. So slide number three, let the spring cleaning of classical actions begin. So what the picture depicts is the causal structure of a general bounded region in spacetime, omega, with boundary del omega. And the point is that the closed region should always have a space-like cap in the past, a space-like cap in the future, a time-like wall surrounding them, and under interfaces, co-dimension two surfaces where the signature flips from one to the other, and the boundary is momentarily null.
Sorry, dear Perimeter, it's very hard to hear with that noise. Is it possible to restart the call or something? It's almost impossible to follow.
We'll restart the call. Hold on a second.
Thank you.
Let's give it a minute to everyone's back.
So there is still noise at the Penn State side.
Does everyone have their microphones muted? Okay, shall we try to continue? Yasha?
Okay, I'm here.
Go ahead.
Okay, so slide number 3. We have a generic bounded region in space-time, and its causal structure, which is sometimes hidden but only superficially so, contains both space-like and time-like patches of the boundary and signature flips between them. Okay, now, people often automatically think of regions as spanning all of space. I do not, so the boundary del omega doesn't have to be at infinity. The normal vector's sign, which is depicted by arrows, is chosen so that the covector is outgoing, so the scalar product with outgoing vectors is positive. Okay. And the sign of n squared behaves as it must on the space-like, time-like, and null patches, which means in particular that n squared can't be chosen constant, such as plus minus 1 everywhere. Okay. Now, with that in mind, we go to slide number 4, where we have the second-order GR action with Einstein-Hilbert bulk term and the Yorke-Gibbons-Hawking boundary term. Okay. And the boundary term has the defining property that it gives the good variational principle in the sense that...
One second, please. So who's the last person they connected? Because that's when the noise started again. Who connected just like a minute ago or less? I guess we don't know.
Come on, Tate.
Okay, let's continue.
All right.
Okay, let's try. There is a variational principle which says that the action variation on shell vanishes for fixed metric at the boundary with no assumptions on its normal derivatives. Okay, so n is the boundary normal, k is its covariant derivative, the extrinsic curvature, and the weird square root of n squared in the denominator of the boundary term is designed to make the formula valid for arbitrary norm and signature of n. So we can use it everywhere on the closed boundary, including at signature flips. Okay? And this means that rescaling n becomes a gauge freedom of the formulation. Okay? Now, slide number 5. So in going to an arbitrarily scaled n, we sacrificed a little bit of niceness, because now it's not a well-defined function of the metric. Okay, so we can't use the unit normal consistently everywhere because n squared has to flip sign. What we can use instead is a densitized normal, which I denote by capital N. Okay, however, in the second order formulation, using it is a little bit awkward because this is an object whose vector index is four-dimensional, but whose density weight is three-dimensional, so covariant derivatives are a bit of a mess. Okay? But in the first-order formalism, this will be nicer, and we'll be able to use it. Okay? So far, just a review of the second-order action. Now, slide number 6 shows the first-order Palatini action with a boundary term that has been slightly patched by us. We added the last piece. Okay, so now the independent variables are the Wilbein E and the connection A. We define sigma, which is the two-form that eats an area element and spits out a normal bivector. F is the curvature of A, and capital N is the same densitized normal as before, so it's a function of the Wilbein. Okay, now, what is going on here in the boundary term? Well, on slide number 7, we have the boundary term as was written previously, which is just the first piece, sigma wedge E. And its purpose is to cancel the variation of A from the bulk term when doing the variational principle. Okay. So the variational principle that S is stationary while keeping only the Wilbein on the boundary fixed is in this way maintained. But this boundary term is not gauge invariant. it is Gaussian variant, and that's why it was kept this way before, as long as you keep the direction of the normal constant in the internal space. However, if you're considering a closed boundary where the signature of the normal changes, you can no longer do that. So overall, the boundary term is not Gaussian variant. Therefore, we need the second piece on slide number 8, which is the sigma wedge and dn piece. And it can be alternatively written in terms of an undensitized normal. The length of the normal cancels between the numerator and denominator anyway. Okay. And what this term does is cancels the gauge transformation of the connection term and makes the boundary term Gaussian variant. Okay. So we have this new piece that's necessary for Gaussian variance. It is non-polynomial, unlike the rest of the action, because of the n squared in the denominator. And it doesn't affect the variational principle, so the variational principle stays clean as before, because everything is a function just of the Wheelbine on the boundary. Okay. So on slide number 9, we are claiming, though not proving here, that the Balkan boundary terms of the second order and first order Pollettini action are now equal on shell separately. So it was already known that the bulk terms agree. The boundary terms now agree thanks to the new NDN addition. Okay. And this happens half on shell. So if in the first order action we impose the equations of motion that the torsion vanishes, then the sigma wedge A minus NDN piece agrees with the Gibbons-Hawking boundary term. Okay, on slide number 10, we extend the discussion to the Holst action. So the first line is the same as before, and the second line is the Holst part. And here again, we have two pieces to the boundary term. Excuse me?
Yasha, a question on page 9.
Yes?
The boundary term in the first order formalism, is it sigma wedge covariant derivative of n?
It's actually sigma wedge the torsion. No, sorry, it's not. I will say exactly what it is in a couple of slides. It can probably be thought of as a covariant derivative of n in some way, but I can't figure it out from the top of my head now. But there will be a nice covariant expression.
Okay.
All right. So on slide number 10, we have the Holst piece of the action with a boundary term. And again, the boundary term has two pieces. Okay. There is an E wedge A part, which performs the same function as the sigma wedge A part in the Pollettini action. It cancels the variation of A and ensures the standard variational principle. And that is, again, not Gaussian variant. So to make it Gaussian variant, we add the final piece, the E wedge DE piece, which then combines with the previous one so that the boundary term is E wedge torsion. Okay? And unlike the NDN piece in the Pollettini action, here the boundary term is entirely polynomial, which will mean later on that funny business with respect to imaginary parts will only happen in the Pollettini sector. Okay, so on slide 11, we summarize the properties of this newly written Holst action. So first of all, both the bulk and the boundary pieces of the Holst term vanish on shell. So again, to say that, we need to assume half the equations of motion, the vanishing of the torsion. Then the boundary term vanishes immediately because it has a factor of the torsion in it. And the bulk term vanishes as usual due to the Bianchi identity E wedge F. Okay. Then the next part is that there was some confusion in the literature concerning whether or not the Holst term in the action should be considered as topological. Okay. So here we are clearly saying that it is not. What is topological is what we write as the boundary term, and its exterior derivative is the Neon density, which is sometimes proposed instead of the host Lagrangian. But as we've seen, the boundary term alone cannot be used if you want the standard variational principle. So the correct bulk boundary combination is unique, and while it vanishes on shell, it is not topological. Okay. On slide 12, we have an alternative expression for the same host action, which is more packed, but more neatly packed, but makes some of its properties more transparent. This is due to Andreas Thurn, who read an early draft of our paper and came up with it. So here, gamma H is a so-called hybrid connection, which is a non-polynomial function of the Wielbein alone. And when written in this form, we see that the Hodge duality structure is clearly there, both in the bulk term in the first row and the boundary term in the second row. And because the boundary term is now written as connection A minus connection gamma, the Gaussian variance now becomes manifest.
Perhaps you could say what hybrid connection means, because people don't know 94
papers. Abai wants me to say what the hybrid connection is. I do not entirely want to, but essentially, it's a connection whose form index is on the boundary, but its internal indices are in the bulk, and it has the property that the covariant derivative written with it annihilates the Wielbein. So it's the correct connection to use for the bulk Wielbein pulled back to the boundary. Okay, so slide 13 summarizes the situation for the different versions of the classical GR action. Well, we have figured out and written down with an iron fist the correct boundary terms for the Palatinian host first order actions. We've seen that the correct host term vanishes on shell, but it isn't topological. In particular, that means that gamma can run in effective field theory. And we've seen that all the actions considered agree on shell, using half the equations of motion, and the bulk and boundary terms happen to agree separately. Okay, this is maybe a good time for questions.
Hi, I have a question. You just stated on the last slide that because the Holst term is non-topological, you expect the emergency parameter to run. Could you explain that a little bit?
I did not say I expect it to run, but it can run, and I'm going to use it in a tangent point later on. The point is that topological contributions to the action are not expected to run in the perturbation theory, but non-topological terms can. So it's just a statement of possibility.
Well, just a little publicity. Some of these statements have been investigated about the running of gamma, at least in perturbation theory.
Absolutely, and I will refer to that. Okay, so the funny business begins on slide number 14. Here we're drawing again the causal structure of a general bounded region, and focusing on the two-dimensional surfaces denoted by empty circles, where the signature of the boundary flips and the normal is momentarily null. Now, the statement is that the action honestly evaluated on this region, the same action formulas that we've written down before, nothing added, has an imaginary part, which is given in GR by 1 over 16G times the sum of the areas of these flip surfaces. And in more general theory, such as Lovelock gravity, it will be given by a quarter times the sum of the world entropy functional evaluated on these surfaces. Okay, so now
screams of horror, ladies fainting in the aisles. How can this possibly be? Slide number 15. So this is sounds like complete nonsense. We know that Lorentzian actions are supposed to be real, which then gives us unitary transition amplitudes e to the is in quantum theory. Where we do encounter imaginary actions is in Euclidean field theory. There they produce exponentially damped amplitudes e to the minus imaginary part, okay? And we associate such things with either tunneling or thermal behavior. Okay? Now, it so happens that gravity did not get this particular memo and that Lorentzian action does have an imaginary part, and I have two things to say in its defense. Now, first of all, gravity has the peculiar property that it admits classical Lorentzian solutions with thermal properties, called black holes.
Hello?
You met a black hole?
We can't hear the speaker.
I can't either. We can't either.
Yash, are you there? Is Penn State connected? Hello?
Hi, we lost connection there.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, so I was on slide 15, saying that gravity does have a certain amount of justification in having a complex Lorentzian action, because first, we do have classical Lorentzian solutions, unlike in non-gravitational field theory, that possess thermal properties, which we call black holes, and imaginary actions tend to be associated with thermal properties. And the second more general point is that we should not be jumping to conclusions saying that something in quantum gravity should obviously be unitary, because for general space-time regions, and I'm speaking here primarily of finite regions, unitarity and the whole notion of the probabilistic content of the theory is not at all understood. Okay? In the few contexts where it is understood, such as in S-matrix scattering amplitudes, the imaginary parts of the relevant actions seems to vanish, okay? Which I will not go into here. It has to do with evaluating the action over the entirety of Minkowski space and such things. At any rate, it appears that the result is consistent with all the situations where we do expect unitary amplitudes, and it seems to be teaching us something about the more general situation.
Sorry, just a question. I don't know if you explained this already, but what is the meaning of the equations of motion coming from the variation of the imaginary part?
Well, there is no such thing, basically. The equations of motion come from the variations of the action at fixed boundary metric or Wielbein. Since the imaginary part only depends on the boundary metric, it doesn't enter into the variation.
Okay.
All right. So on slide number 16, we are beginning to discuss how the imaginary parts can be derived. Okay. And first of all, it is coming from the boundary term. Okay. The bulk term is perfectly legit and does nothing funny, but the boundary term has these n squared in the denominator, which can go wild when the signature flips and the n is null. So the imaginary part will be coming from integrating the boundary term through the signature flip surfaces. Okay, and this is the reason why it was not noticed before, because essentially people were always integrating over just the space-like and the time-like patches. Okay, so in the second-order formulation, it's arising from the Gibbons-Hawking boundary term, and in the first-order formulation, it's arising specifically from the new NDN piece of the boundary term, and therefore could not have been seen in the boundary term as it was written previously. On slide 17.
Sorry, yes, I'm confused at this stage. Why, you know, you started from an imagined real action, like page whatever 12. So, what did you add up to the action to get something imaginary? There's something you're doing there. It's not clear.
Absolutely nothing. The action,
so your action is
in the bulk.
Page 12, right? Your action is page 12.
Yes.
Am I correct?
Yes, that's the action.
This action is read, right?
No. And I will get around to explaining that very, very soon.
So what is not read in this action? A is read. Is the gamma hybrid connection?
Gamma H is giving an imaginary part when
but
integrated.
You told us what gamma H is. So I guess I'll reiterate Abai's comment. Can we know what... Because if I go back to page 10... Okay, page 10, the action is purely real.
Yes, that is better. So on page 10, the imaginary part is coming from the NDN over N squared part because of the divergence when N squared goes to zero. Let me go on for 2 minutes, and then we will see if there is still a problem.
Okay.
All right. So we are on slide 17. Okay. This story is simplest to tell in 1 plus 1 dimensional gravity. Okay. There, the sigma, which was a 2 form, becomes just the 2 dimensional epsilon tensor with no form indices. Okay. And for starters, we can look at the trivial flat space situation and take the trivial gauge where A is zero, so that the only term that does not vanish in the action is the boundary term in the second order formulation or the NDN boundary term in the first order formulation. Okay. Now, in 2 dimensions, these expressions have a very simple geometric meaning. Okay, the integrals just count up the angle by which the normal vector rotates as we go around the boundary. Okay, so they become an integral over an angle d alpha. And then the question is, what does this integral equal when done around a closed path? The boundary here is just a closed 1D curve. Okay, so in the Euclidean, we know that actions integrate to 2 pi in flat space. And in the Lorentzian, we happen to know, although not widely enough, that the angles integrate to 2 pi I. So as far as I know, this was first noticed by Raphael Sorkin in his thesis in the 70s. Okay, and this is a very neat fact about Lorentzian geometry, which is crucial to my case here. So let us give more details on it on slide 18. The statement is the following. If we want to assign consistently boost angles to every point, or equivalently to every vector, in the 1 plus 1 dimensional Lorentzian plane, then these angles must be taken complex. Okay? So real angles can only serve us within a single quadrant of the plane, where they go from minus to plus infinity, as boost angles do. And then it turns out that if we want to go through a signature flip, cross a null direction and move over to an adjacent quadrant, then the angle has to pick up an imaginary contribution half pi I. Then in the next quadrant, again, at constant imaginary part, the real part sweeps from minus to plus infinity. Again, a half pi I at the next null crossing, and so on it goes, such that the total angle integrated over a closed path 2 pi I, and the real infinities all cancel. my favorite way to derive this fact is shown on slide 19. So I expect that you will believe me about the real part of the angle. The interesting question is, how does the half pi I jump work? And the way I like to do it is to write my two-dimensional vector that's moving around in the 1+1D plane as a combination of two null basis vectors, big L and small l, where z is the ratio of their two coefficients in the combination. And then it's easy to convince yourself that the boost angle, as the vector changes, is related to this z logarithmically, so the alpha is the z over 2z, and essentially because boosts stretch one of the null vectors and squeeze accordingly the other one. And when you follow this within a given quadrant of the plane, you get the usual results of hyperbolic trigonometry and the real part going from minus to plus infinity. Now, the interesting part is what happens at a signature flip when n crosses through a null direction, such as that of capital L. There, the ratio z crosses through 0, and the integral d alpha, which is z over 2z, has a pole. Now, what we like to do with poles is to deform the integration contour into the complex z-plane to avoid them. Okay, so we can deform either above or below z equals 0, and that will give two complex conjugate results. The difference between them is given by the closed contour integral, which means that the imaginary part of the angle across a signature flip is 1 over 2i times the closed contour integral, which gives half pi. Okay, so questions here?
Yes, Laurent, yeah.
Sorry, well, maybe I think it's clearer. I think the thing so let's go back to page 17.
Yes.
So I guess, okay, if I look at page 17, I still have my puzzle, is that the left-hand side is real, right? And the right-hand side, you know, therefore cannot be purely imaginary. So if you want something purely imaginary in the right-hand side, if you want the alpha to be purely imaginary, you have to put an I in the left-hand side. So I guess, you know, I'm extrapolating what you're saying. What you're saying is that what you're doing is that instead of writing the left-hand side as it is, you put something like n dot n plus I epsilon in the denominator. You need to put the I in the left-hand side if you want it to appear at some point, right? I cannot have spontaneous
tension. Right. The bypassing of the pole can be expressed as an I epsilon in the denominator, yes.
Exactly. So now, okay, which is fine. And now, you know, if I put a complex action, I get a complex result, there's no problem. I'm good with it. But there's another question, which is, okay, it seems kind of natural, but, you know, somehow there's another question that arises. Why we do that? What does it mean to put this I epsilon there?
Wonderful. So that is what I would very much like to find out. Why do I do it? Well, otherwise I don't know how to integrate through a pole. Okay, that's just a way to make the expression well-defined. As for what does it mean, well, I don't have an answer that I am happy with. I have a number of stories about the properties of this thing, that it reproduces the entropy formula for general theories of gravity, that when evaluated on all sorts of special regions in symmetric spacetimes, it gives sensible results related to the relevant entropy. But the end statement is that I don't know and I'm trying to find out.
Okay.
In this talk, we will see one interesting consequence.
Okay. So now it's clear that that's a fundamental hypothesis, that you put this I epsilon to regularize, you know. But there could be others, like principal value. Or I agree that I epsilon seems always more appealing, but usually
yeah.
We have... it's still hanging out. Okay, thanks.
So, I mean, one possibility, I don't know if this works to understand physically what is happening, is if one could actually extend all this to the asymptotically flat context. And in that case, one could also try to start from this Lagrangian formulation and go to the Hamiltonian formulation, following the route that Hawking and Horowitz had taken. I mean, there were some issues of that particular calculation, but the final result is fine. And they showed that there was a relation between the surface term that Gibbons-Hawking write down and the Hamiltonian that we get, the normal ADM Hamiltonian one gets in the... So it will be very interesting to see if one can do this at infinity, in particular if the boundary term that you added, the new one, is actually regular at infinity. Then what would happen to the Hamiltonian framework in this particular way? It may or may not give you great insight, but that is one avenue.
Yes, so similar things are being done in a paper that will come out soon, and I mentioned at the Perimeter seminar, but I don't know. For now, let me just add that I do have an ideological objection to taking the principal part, because the principal part is essentially an average of two actions, of the two possible deformations around the pole. And in quantum mechanics, we should not be averaging actions, we should be averaging amplitudes, which are e to the I actions. Buy it if you wish, that is my argument.
Yeah, no, maybe. I mean, I'm not saying it's natural, but I'm just saying here we're talking about mathematics, right? So the question is, what physical principle, you know, lies behind regularizing one way or the other? The principle value is just that, you know, it shows there's real way to do it. Might not be good, but anyway.
All right. So we are on slide 20. Where we are back from counting angles to the GR action in 1 plus 1 dimensions. Okay, and we just found out that the action for any region in flat space is 1 over 8 pi g times the total angle 2 pi I, which is I over 4g. Okay, we saw that it arises from the four poles in the NDN boundary term that occur at signature flipped where n goes null. And there was an arbitrary choice of sign involved. I was free to choose the sign of I in the analytical continuation. I am choosing it ad hoc so that the imaginary part of the action comes out positive, which produces a damped rather than exploding amplitude e to the is. Okay. Then the next question is, what will happen in curved space, such as when there's matter? And the statement is that this will only change the action's real part, so that the imaginary part will remain 1 over 4g. Okay,
a quick question from Marseille.
Yes?
This is Hal Haggard. I'm curious, have you studied the relationship between these flip terms and the corner terms that Eugenio Bianchi and Wolfgang Weiland studied?
Yes. So essentially, the statement is that corner terms have an imaginary part when the corner is involves the signature flip, or two, or more. So this can all be formulated in terms of corner terms, yes. All right. So curvature means deficit angles. But deficit angles are real, okay? And the imaginary part will still come in the same way from the signature flips, whose number does not change. And from each signature flip, there will be a half pi I as before. Okay, so we will still have the same poles in the NDN boundary integral, and no funny business arising from the bulk term or the A boundary piece, which will exist in curved space. Right. On slide 21, we are upgrading this business to higher dimensions and claiming that everything, the only thing that changes now is that the imaginary flip surface contributions get multiplied by the area of the flip surface. So what is happening is that the imaginary part is still coming due to poles in the sigma wedge NDN boundary term. Okay, the poles are still coming where n becomes null, so these are now two-dimensional surfaces. And on these surfaces, there is just one component of the numerator which contributes to the divergence and therefore to the imaginary part, which is when we take the form indices on sigma along the flip surface, the form index on dn in perpendicular to it along the null normal, which is also tangent because it's null. And then the ij indices must be in the 1 plus 1d plane orthogonal to the flip surface, which is the analog of the 1 plus 1d plane that we had before in the two-dimensional discussion. Okay, then the calculation reduces to the same one that we had before, except that the component of sigma ij, the only component that contributes, provides a factor of the area density, which means that there's an area factor in the result. Okay, now slide 22 begins the transition to the LQG story. So here, I am considering a flat four simplex in Minkowski space and still classically evaluating its action. Now, as we know, the action arises entirely from the boundary term, from the extrinsic curvature, and the extrinsic curvature is entirely concentrated on the 2D corners, which for a simplex are triangles. Okay, so the action is the sum of triangle areas times dihedral angles, theta, divided by 8 pi g. And these dihedral angles, which are discrete versions of the extrinsic curvature, can be complex for the same reasons we discussed before. Okay? In particular, in LQG, we are considering always space-like hypersurfaces, and space-like hypersurfaces can intersect at the corner in two different ways, so-called the thick corner depicted on the left and the thin corner depicted on the right. Okay? In the left case, there is no signature flip involved. The boundary just rotates by a real angle. And on the right, there are two signature flips, because if we resolve the corner into a continuous curve, we see that to get a future pointing normal into a past pointing normal, we must go through a space-like orientation and go through a null orientation twice. So that the imaginary part of the angle for a thin corner is twice half pi, which makes pi. Okay? Therefore, the action has an imaginary part given by the sum of the areas of the thin corners divided by AG. Okay? Now, let us go look for it in the spin foam amplitude. So, slide number 23. I will be looking at the EPRL amplitude as studied in 2010 by the Nottingham group in the large spin limit for a coherent state of a four simplex. Okay. It was shown by them that the amplitude is composed of two pieces coming from two stationary points of a quote-unquote path integral. Okay. The two stationary points are two parity-related configurations of the four simplex. If we want, we can isolate one of them by also smearing over the sizes of spins. Okay. And the effective actions, S plus minus, if translated into the language that I am using here now, take the form written in the top right. Okay, so we have a first piece, which the Nottingham group would call the dihedral angle, but I am now calling the real part of the dihedral angle, because there is also an imaginary part. And there is a second piece, which is zero for thick corners and pi for thin corners. And now I can identify it as the imaginary part of the angle. Okay? And there is a ratio between them equal to plus minus the Immerti parameter. And the plus minus depicts the denotes the two stationary points. All right. So on slide 24, we are making the translation from spins, which were the variables on slide 23, to areas in order to better compare to the classical action. Okay. At large spins, I will take the areas to be proportional to J, and the proportionality coefficient is 8 pi G square root of gamma squared, okay, which can also be written as sine of gamma times gamma. And I am insisting on writing it this way. So first of all, this way and not as gamma in order to be able to cover both sines, and this way and not as the absolute value, because the absolute value has an agreed upon meaning in the complex plane, which is not complex analytic. So square root gamma squared is as complex analytic as possible. Okay, how analytic is that? Square root gamma squared, or equivalently sine of gamma, can be analytically continued to two separate domains of the complex plane, which are disjoint from each other. So one domain that contains necessarily the positive real line, where the sine is plus, and one that contains the negative real line, where the sine is minus. And away from the real line, we can choose the boundary between the domains as we please, and we will use that freedom soon. Okay. And in these variables, the action takes the form at the top right, which is repeated again at the top of slide 25. Okay. So now let's stare at it. The old interpretation of this action would be that, wonderful, it reproduces the classical action for arbitrary real gamma, because the second term, if we reintroduce the spins, is an integer multiple of pi and can be thrown away, while the first term reproduces the classical action up to sine. But now we know that it doesn't. The first term only reproduces the real part. But, of course, it is now highly tempting to say that we can reproduce the entire action correctly by using the second term in S plus minus, if only we analytically continue gamma to sine times I. Now, then the real part of theta and the imaginary part of theta will match up correctly into theta itself. So I am choosing the sine of the I in the analytical continuation again to give positive imaginary part to the actions, so non-exploding amplitudes. Okay? And positive and negative gammas go to different sines of I, which is fine, because to begin with, we have two separate analytic domains, and we should not be expecting agreement between them. Right? So after the substitution, the action, the effective action, takes the form in slide 26. Okay? It reproduces the classical action up to sine of the real part, which is the same situation that we had before. The e to is plus and e to is minus, the two amplitudes of the two stationary points, are still complex conjugate to each other, as they were before the imaginary part was noticed. Okay. And now we are free to think, what does this mean? Okay. So it appears that the classical action is correctly reproduced when we set gamma to plus minus I, so somehow the theory wants to go back to the self-dual Ashtekar variable. Of course, we don't know how to quantize with gamma non-real, so instead we have to go now through this tortuous path of quantizing with real gamma, and then analytically continuing at the very end. So in this approach, gamma gets treated, real gamma gets treated as a regulator that is removed at the end. Okay, questions so far? All right. Now, on slide 27, there is a marvelous convergence with a quite different calculation, which was done in late 2012 by Frodengeiler, Nui, and Perez, which was, in fact, the original reason we even considered sending gamma to plus minus I in our context. Okay? That is a calculation of black hole entropy. Now, there is a general situation in LQG where we say that the entropy calculation agrees with the Bekenstein-Hawking formula up to a constant coefficient, and then is that constant coefficient correct or not? Do we need to set gamma to a special value? Well, it seems that the correct answer here is that we don't know. And the reason we don't know is that the usual LQG state counting calculation uses, for instance, the Newton's constant of the fundamental theory as formulated at the Planck scale, while the Bekenstein-Hawking formula uses Newton's constant, or more generally, the coefficients of the action in the continuum semi-classical limit. And these don't have to be the same, so we are simply not in a position to compare the two results because we don't have an independent calculation of an effective continuum action from fundamental LQG. Now, this situation is different in the large spin limit. So, as we know, we do have a calculation of an effective action, and we have just corrected it slightly in the previous slide. So we can also do state counting restricted to large spins, as was done in the Frodengeiler Nui Perez paper. And the result is that the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy is reproduced, but again, if and only if gamma is analytically continued to plus minus I. So now we have a very nice agreement that in the large spin limit, sending gamma to plus minus I leads both to a correct action with the correct relation between the real and imaginary parts, and to a correct entropy, which matches the constant coefficient against the Newton G in the effective action, which in this case is the same as the G of the fundamental theory, unlike in the continuum. All right. So this brings us to slide 28. Can you still hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Yes, fine. We're hearing and following with interest.
Yes, we hear you.
So this leads us to the question, what is in fact the relation between the large spin limit that we've been studying and the continuum which we dream of reproducing? Now, we've seen that large spin LQG with gamma going to plus minus I reproduces certain key properties of continuum GR, such as the correct action and the correct entropy formula, but this happens non-trivially. Okay? In the continuum, we've seen that gamma doesn't matter for anything. The whole term of the action vanishes on shell. And the imaginary part comes exclusively from the non-Holst boundary term, which has nothing to do with gamma. On the other hand, in the large spin limit, gamma, as long as you're not throwing away that second piece, does matter to the result. And the imaginary part of the action is coming entirely from the 1 over gamma term, which heuristically should arise from the Holst term in the action. Okay? So the reproducing of the imaginary part is therefore, in a sense, a large quantum effect because the action gets seriously rearranged. And it looks in this context that the two limits are in fact different, and is there a nice way to understand the difference between them? So here, Norbert's first reaction on slide 29 was, well, it's an RG flow. Okay, gamma flows in some sense from the continuum where its value is arbitrary and doesn't matter to anything to the self-dual value which it must have in the large spin limit. And now, as it turns out and was mentioned earlier, there is a perturbative calculation by Benedetti and Speziale of one loop running of gamma in Euclidean gravity with fermions, fermions because then there is, in fact, a running at one loop. And they have shown that gamma squared flows from arbitrary values in the IR to the self-dual value 1 in the Euclidean in the UV. Okay? Now, this calculation can only be treated as suggestive if we take the UV part of it seriously, because UV here means transplanckian, and we should definitely not be trusting one-loop perturbative calculations at transplanckian energies, but still it gives us something to think about, okay? Because this sounds a lot like the situation we just encountered. So can we match up the words to each other? So gamma is arbitrary in the IR, well, the continuum is definitely the IR, and it gets a self-dual value in the UV, so is the large spin limit in some sense the UV?
I have a question about that.
Yes.
In fact, I wanted to ask precision from Simone about, you know, the way you quote the results, is that I thought it was scheme dependent. Simone, would you agree with that, that really it's a flow from arbitrary value to imaginary value?
There are some, right, some aspects to be mentioned. First of all, the calculation is Euclidean, so self-dual here really means gamma equal plus or minus 1, not I. If you do it in the Lorentzian, then it's a different story, and the fixed points are not the self-dual ones, unfortunately for your argument. And also, of course, there's a dependence on the initial conditions, but also the other point is that this ultraviolet fixed point also corresponds to blowing up of the interactions, so it's not so much that it's on the ultraviolet, but it's certainly that you are outside of the regime of perturbation theory, so as you said, you can at most take it as some indications, it's not so solid.
Very well, so thank you, I did not know about the Lorentzian result, and in any case, everyone is now welcome to forget all about the last paragraph, because it really only plays a suggestive role in what follows. So, on slide 30, let's try to disentangle this UV-IR terminology. So, I would like to say that we should not be using these words in quantum gravity at all, lest we become confused. So, the large spin limit definitely, no doubt, describes large distances, which are of the order square root j times Planck length. But in quantum gravity, large distances can correspond to either large or small energy. Right? So large distances make small energies if we are in a QFT particle context. Okay? Then long wavelengths correspond to small energy particles. In the classical GR context, large distances lead dimensionally to large energies, which can be interpreted, for instance, as the large mass of a large black hole. Okay? So if we have a length L much larger than the Planck length, then we can interpret it either as corresponding to an energy that's much smaller than the Planck mass, or to an energy that's much larger than the Planck mass. And the question is, which is the correct interpretation in our context? Right? So what follows is completely heuristic and on the level of matching words, but I think is still somehow significant. So in the QST picture, where we are discussing particles, so long distances mean long wavelength gravitons that are perturbing a background that is there, and in particular, if the background is there, then it's possible to probe smaller distances inside it if you want. And the action of such a quantum over the distance L is more or less by the definition of the wavelengths of order 1. Okay? And on the other hand, in the classical GR picture, where we have large energies, this is about something like large black holes, which are defining a background. And not perturbing it. And the action over a region of size L. Of course, discounting things like singularities, for instance, looking at L outside the horizon, is of order L over L Planck squared, which is much larger than 1. Okay. So which of these is the large spin limit more similar to? Well, I would claim that it's more similar to the classical GR story. Okay. A large spin state in LQG is defining a background and not perturbing it. In fact, there is a certain story in which single intertwiners in LQG can be interpreted as a certain quantum version of black holes, but that is not entirely necessary for the argument. And we see a small number of elements with this large size L that have a very large action, and that is the reason why we talk about semi-classical actions in the large spin limit at all. So therefore, I propose that we should be thinking about the large spin limit as a high-energy limit, where individual elements of the geometry have energy which is square root j times larger than M Planck. I think Abai wants to say something.
I was just wondering what you mean by action of a graviton.
Well, if we write the action of a particle in the special relativistic mechanics moving in a background, then the Broglie wavelength of that particle is defined as the length over which that action is 2 pi, in that sense.
So that's much more useful than the GR, anyway, and you're using a classical GR.
So the picture I'm advocating is depicted on slide 31. Okay, we have in the middle the fundamental formulation of LQG, which is presumably dominated by spins of order 1, and thus by quanta with the energy of order M Planck. And then there are two opposite classical limits of this that one may consider. One classical limit to the left is presumably achieved by coarse graining over many small elements and having some sort of notion of RG flow into the continuum, where we have quanta such as gravitons with characteristic energies much smaller than M Planck, and that's the continuum classical GR. On the other hand, to the right, we have a different limit, where we just take the spins to be very large, with no notion of coarse graining involved. We just consider a special subsector of states in the fundamental theory, and we get LQG with very large spins, which, as we've seen, behaves as discrete classical GR in various key ways. And it should be thought of as involving quanta with energies much larger than the Planck mass. So the continuum limit and the large spin limit, opposite classical limits of the theory, continuum limit describing many low energy quanta comprising the classical field, and the large spin limit describing few high energy quanta describing the large chunks of geometry. A disclaimer at this point, often the large spin limit is discussed, at least heuristically, in the context of a coarse graining procedure, so that it's supposed to be a coarse grained description of continuum states. Okay? That may well be possible, and that is not the large spin limit that I am discussing here. Of course, it must then be said that if we do have some coarse graining procedure, then it should also affect the dynamics through RG flow, and therefore various calculations such as effective actions we may be forced to redo them. Okay. So on slide 32, there is again the summary of the results. We cleaned up the boundary terms, various formulations of the classical action of GR, We talked about the fact that the action has an imaginary part. We've seen that in the large spin foams, the vertex amplitude reproduces the new classical action with the imaginary part, if and only if we analytically continue to gamma equals plus minus I. This leads to an agreement with an independent calculation of black hole states, also in the large spin limit. And we waxed philosophical about thinking of the large spin limit as a limit of high energy Transplanckian energies. And slide 33, a short list of new questions arising from these stories. Okay, so first of all, it seems imperative to understand the imaginary part of the action. What does it mean? Like quantum path integrals, unitarity, entropy, what is it trying to tell us? Since we have seen that the large spin limit of LQG wants gamma to be plus minus I in more ways than one, then I would bet several parts of my life that there has to be a way to quantize with gamma equals plus minus I directly instead of going through the first route that we were forced to take. And since I'm infatuated with null geometric structures, as some of you know, I hope that they might provide a way to do this. Okay. And finally, the heuristic interpretation of the large spin limit as a high energy regime, I think should lead us to rethink the notion of IR divergences in spin foam amplitudes, because they are certainly IR divergences in the sense of large distance, but now we are saying that they should also be thought of as a window into ever higher energies that doesn't stop at the Planck mass, and this could have some conceptual implications worth thinking about. I'm done. Thank you.
Questions?
Okay, slide 31.
Yeah, so, I mean, in order to come to this idea, which is I'm looking at the arrow on the right-hand side, which is LQG with J much bigger than 1, discrete classical GR.
Yes.
So that is the limit that people have been considering, quite implicitly considering in the, looking at the semi-classical limit of the action and so on. And I agree that that sort of makes look like E is much bigger than Mach 1 plus Planck mass. But I think it is in the same sense as, for example, my pen has an energy much, much bigger than Mach Planck, because Planck mass is 10 to the minus 5 grams, and it is, you know, I don't know, 100 grams, so it's much bigger than Planck mass Planck. But I wouldn't call my pen to be a quantum. You know, it is actually coarse-grained, or it is also, it has total energy like that. So I don't agree, or I don't understand in the middle caption here, transparency. I agree that continuum limit any low energy quanta, and then large spin limit few high energy quanta. I don't know the word quanta there, and this really does tie in with the last remarks that you made, because it's not clear to me that there really are quanta. I mean, it could just be a macroscopic object, right? I mean, we are looking at kind of classical geometry, discretized with classical geometry, which correspond to macroscopic objects, and macroscopic objects have energy much bigger than the Planck mass. So I'm not sure that I agree. In fact, I don't agree with the word that there really are few high energy quanta, as opposed to the total energy is much larger than the Planck energy.
So it sounded to me as if we do agree. So in the continuum where things such as pens live, certainly you can have objects with the energy much larger than M Planck, but these objects live in a space made of very, very many Planck scale elements over which we have to coarse grain, and there is no gravitational quantum in this context with energy larger than M Planck. On the other hand, in the large spin limit, we have these large, say, triangular tetrahedral chunks of geometry, which are single quanta. They have no substructure. You cannot fit a pen inside them because you can't resolve any intermediate points. Intermediate points don't exist. So I don't see the disagreement.
Yeah, so the disagreement would just be, so I agree with you that the pens do live in the left-hand side of the continuum. So the disagreement really just has to do with the, what do you take this large J physically, discrete object, as? So I think my understanding is always that it has always been that these discrete objects are not fundamental things, just like the regime calculus thing. It's not a fundamental thing. It is just a way of approximating the continuous geometry by kind of assigning a fewer degrees of freedom. So these degrees of freedom are not physical. I mean, the usual thing in regime calculus was, at least,
Can I comment there? The gist of loop quantum gravity is that these states are states of quantum gravity, so they are real. Otherwise you would treat quantum gravity as some kind of approximate discretization, but it's not what it's supposed to be. It's supposed to be a continuum formulation at the quantum level of the theory. If that's the case, then these graphs and spins are, you know, that's what we're claiming, right?
The question is really the interpretation. So I'm not clear that I'm claiming that. That's my main point, I guess. In the sense that if I look at, in quantum electrodynamics, if I look at the electric field, right, in this room, I mean, I think that the electric field is just made up of those photons. Now, I might approximate in some coarse-grained way as saying that, well, the total energy is this. But to me, that is only kind of an approximation. In other words, the theory does allow photons with single photons with arbitrary large energy.
But I think we always emphasize that gravity is different from electromagnetism, you know, because of different invariants. And if I understand the, you know, in fact, you made the argument with Jersey that this Hilbert space is carries a continuum representation. So if we believe, and I think this is why loop gravity is interesting. This is the statement that these discrete states have a continuum, you know, meaning. Of course, we don't. It's very different than just saying, oh, this is just some kind of Regé approximation of gravity. I mean, right? This is why loop quantum gravity is interesting. Because it claims that it captures the continuum theory at the quantum level.
I would like to interject here. So I think the point Abai was making is precisely the point made at the bottom of slide 31, which is that the large spin limit can be considered in two different contexts. So it's the same mathematical structure that can be used for two different purposes. What Abai was referring to is that it is perhaps possible, yet to be shown that this actually works, to consider large spin states as effective descriptions of finer continuum states that are really made up of many small spins. And that is not the situation I am considering. Instead, I am considering the situation which is in any case always there. It must always be possible to just take special states in the fundamental theory that happen to have large spins, with no coarse graining implied, and then they have this Trans-Planckian interpretation.
Yeah, I think both what Laura and Yasha are saying is a mainstream point of view, and it's also the point of view, as you said, Laura, that I have expressed many times, that this is already the continuum and so on. But my point is just that there may be an alternate way of looking. So, as I've said, that we are not shown anything like that, that there is an alternate way of looking at it. But it's not inconceivable. I mean, it's possible that, in fact, these large J's, the states with large J's, are really, and kind of a really like coherent states in some sense. I mean, they really are obtained from some coarse graining. It's an approximate description. In other words, maybe our fundamental, I mean, it's not impossible is what all I'm saying. I'm not saying it is something that is forced upon us. And I'm agreeing with both Laura and Yasha that the mainstream point of view is to take all these states on the same footing. Very large J, as well as very, very many small J's, which make up a macroscopic configuration. So I don't think there's a fundamental disagreement, but I'm just sort of emphasizing, because it is not a mainstream point of view, that perhaps what one might be led to is the second point of view, in which the large J's arise only through coarse grain.
More questions? Okay, let's thank Jess again.